Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Yeah, but it's a holiday. Do I have to? This is John. Hi, how are you? It's 108, and we're in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue here all the way until 3 o'clock. It's a very weird day because it took, at least for me anyway, Thursday off, Friday off, Saturday off. Sunday we didn't work. Today's Monday, back to work, but it's kind of one of those hybrid days where if you're working, you're not working hard. The markets were... Ryan, the markets only open for half a day, right?
Correct. They finished up. They were up 200 points, so people were buying and selling to begin the day, but then everyone went off, I guess, to go vacation.
Kellyanne Conway's right. The markets love, if not this president, they love this time. The markets are really doing well. I don't know if Hillary were president, would the markets be doing as well, or if a different Republican were president, would the markets be doing well? But the markets are. And I think that's buying a lot of us with angst these days as we watch the president kind of flip out on Twitter. That's buying us a little time, a little like, okay, but even though he seems to be losing his mind, the markets aren't theirs. And so your 401ks and your pension plans and whatever money you're trying to stow away someday seems to be doing pretty well. There's some consolation in that. I also found some consolation on Sunday, reading the newspaper. The New York Times printed out a special section. It was in its entirety with annotations on either margin, the Constitution. And I know you know of it, and you probably know the first sentence in it, and you recognize a few points about it, but you haven't read the whole thing, and you don't know the whole thing. And so I started to read the thing and didn't finish it myself. But I found it was very interesting. I found it was refreshing. The New York Times said that they print it once in a while, I think, maybe when the country could just use a little primer on who we are and what we are as a people. It's quite appropriate on the 4th of July weekend as well to sort of take stock. And so I'm just reading the thing, and I find it's really interesting. We the people of the United... Don't worry, I'm not going to read it all. We the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, which they spelled D-E-F-E-N-C-E, ha ha ha, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. I mean, if you just care to think about it for a minute, you do get a little goosebumpy going, yeah, we weren't always there. These things that we take for granted or that we get outraged when we feel they are infringed upon weren't even there until our founding fathers said, hey, we're going to start a new country. What should it look like? What will it act like? What will it be? And so Article 1, Section 1 is the only one I'm just going to read right now, and it says, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of a Senate and a House of Representatives. You know, and I'm reading this yesterday, and I think, well, it didn't say the king has all the power, or the president, or the supreme leader, whatever you want to call him. It's the people. They have two bodies, the Senate and then the House, and then they go through how those will be constructed, and you sort of feel good about it in principle. I mean, there's the 3/5 clause in there, and you'll feel terrible about humanity when you read that part. And then it goes to the 25th Amendment, which, as I'm reading through this, is trending on Twitter over the weekend. The 25th Amendment, which is how you can get rid of the president if you don't feel he's capable. Maybe he's been shot and he's incapable. Maybe it's something else. But the 25th Amendment speaks to that. A professor of constitutional law I like to talk to is named Dave Schultz. He's a professor of law at the University of Minnesota. And he joins us on WGN Radio to just kind of catch us up on a few things worth noting on the long holiday weekend. Hi, Dave. It's John Williams. How are you?
Okay, I'm doing fine today. How are you folks doing?
Are you at a cookout?
No, I was just weeding my garden.
Well, I appreciate you giving us 10, 15 minutes of your time here.
No problem at all.
You were listening to my little monologue about the Constitution. You're a guy who's dedicated his life to this. What do you think about it, generally speaking, as a document?
As a document, it was a brilliant piece of work in 1787, and it is still brilliant in many ways. And there are times, though, where I have to remind people that it's a document, you know, created in 1787, that's getting a little old. There may be a few things that we may need to tinker with here and there, but I'm always amazed at how, when push comes to shove, how the Constitution still works. Before the election, or actually after the election, when so many people were worried about what was going to happen with Donald Trump being elected, I said, there's this amazing thing called the Constitution and the Bill of Rights that has things like separation of powers and checks and balances and the First Amendment. And I said, guess what? Presidents are not kings. Presidents are not like, what was it, you know, Captain Picard on Star Trek, who said, make it so and make it so. That Trump would start to realize or start to confront the realities of our constitutional system. And in his first 6 months, I think that's true. I think he has been stymied in ways, either good and bad, depending on your perspective, because our Constitution makes it hard for people to become dictators.
So is Donald Trump the sort of person that the Founding Fathers anticipated when they wrote this language?
I think it is. I think that they were anticipating somebody who would be either trying to be an all-powerful person, or the phrase they use in the Federalist Papers, which is sort of the definitive gloss on the Constitution, written by James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, and John Jay. They were also worried about what they called factions. In modern language, we would call those special interest groups. And so the framers were worried about special interest groups. They were worried about strong presidents. They were worried about overzealous courts and Congress. In general, they were worried about how any one person or any one institution could try to abuse its power over time, and how there needed to be some, again, checks and balances, separation of powers,
yeah,
ways to prevent somebody or some institution from dominating the political system.
And I suppose it's true, too, that the intentions of this person, you said, abuse the power of the presidency, but it may be that their intention is good. Suppose the president, I mean, I believe this, I suspect you do too, that the president's ban on immigration was not because he wanted to strike out at any people per se, but because he wanted to follow through on a campaign pledge to make America safer. If that's the same way he feels about the integrity of the elections, all evidence to the contrary, he feels that elections are being rigged. People are voting illegally, 3 to 5 million of them. We've got to crack down on this. His intentions are good, but it almost doesn't matter what your intentions are. There's a process, isn't there? And even if you're right, even if you're well-intended, it doesn't mean you get to have your will. And I think we're seeing an extraordinary period of time right now where, boy, hang on to your Constitution, because this is all you got.
No, you're absolutely correct. I was going to say, take us back, you know, in time to an earlier era, for example, an Abraham Lincoln, or let's say a Franklin Roosevelt, people who would, many historians would hold up as what, our greatest presidents. Even then, the people who were, let's say, well-intentioned, the Constitution placed limits on what they could do. And that's important, because I think what our framers were saying is that, I'll put it in my language, efficient governments are also governments that are dangerous and threatening of individual rights. There is a process, a set of rules that have to be followed.
You said efficient governments?
Efficient governments with a capital E can threaten individual liberty. What I mean by efficient, those without checks and balances, those that just let somebody say, again, make it so, make it happen.
Yeah. That's a running joke on this show, David. You know from having listened to me maybe a little when I was on the air in Minnesota, but I like to say, when I get to be king someday, my intentions are always good. And the beauty of having a king is he could be very efficient. He could just say, oh, no, we're building the wall, or, oh, no, those people from that country can't come in. That's just the way. Or we are going to start jailing journalists because they're telling lies about me. And a king could pull that off, you know?
Yes, a king could definitely do that. and many of us would cheer because, as you know, for example, right now, just to pick one subject here, what is it? Probably journalists should be happy that used car salespeople exist and members of Congress exist because people don't like journalists, but they like them a little bit more than used car salespeople or members of Congress. But it doesn't matter, you know, whether we like journalists or not. The fact of the matter is there's a thing called the First Amendment out there that protects freedom of the press. I may not like the fact that my next-door neighbor has opinions contrary to me, but guess what? The beauty of the First Amendment free speech is that he gets to speak his mind, I get to speak my mind. And that's the process. You know, nobody has a monopoly of knowledge. Nobody has a monopoly on truth. Mm-hmm. And in a democracy or representative democracy, the idea is that, again, as you were quoting in the beginning, we the people get to make the decision. Now, I the person, not I the king, but we the people get to make that call.
Dave Schultz is a constitutional law professor on WGN Radio. Well, you don't think that the president himself, though, is doing anything that violates the First Amendment? I mean, he can be unethical or tacky or mean-spirited or juvenile, but he has, I presume, the same rights to retweet a video that has CNN superimposed in a wrestling match where he body slams CNN. That's legal, and we should support his right to do that, right?
He has a First Amendment right to do that, whether or not we think it's a smart idea to do that.
No, I didn't ask that.
That's exactly my point here, is that from a constitutional perspective, he has First Amendment rights that he can exercise.
But when you do go down the path, I'm going to just go back to this in my 2 o'clock hour. I know the president blew up the internet once again over the weekend, but in my own small way, I did too. When I got dozens of likes and comments, and people were talking about the cuckoo Trump brackets that I've been building, moments that gave you pause and you went, like him or hate him. Holy cow, can you believe what he said or tweeted next? We start with the golden escalator ride where he announces his candidacy and rides down the escalator. When I saw that, I thought that was such a bizarre scene that he'll never figure it out. He'll never succeed if that's his idea of entering a press conference to announce his candidacy. Well, I've been wrong about everything since. But we use that as a starting point. We say, okay, give me your craziest Trump moments. And I really decided to start sort of creating this list when he, when we had the Time magazine thing, and it was discovered that some of the Time magazine covers have been faked. But from then, we've got one more bizarre after another. Dave, all of this to get to this point in question, and that is some of the stuff lately looks so unhinged that people are talking about the 25th Amendment. And that is a process by which you would remove a president. Mike, you're the expert here. Can you kind of tell me a little bit about how the 25th Amendment works and what it means and why it's there?
Well, the 25th Amendment came about, it actually was ratified and became an amendment in 1967. And even though throughout history we know we've had several presidents assassinated or who died in office, William Henry Harrison, we had Abraham Lincoln, we had McKinley, we never had a really clear process at that point regarding, you know, succession or what happens if somebody becomes ill in terms of, you know, who takes over. And during the Eisenhower administration, he had, I think, a couple of heart attacks, incapacitated, nothing really clear regarding, you know, who takes over or what happens like that. And then, of course, you know, we had the Kennedy assassination. And so I say that because the 25th Amendment tries to clarify sort of presidential succession, who takes over, when the president can pass, let's say, authority over to somebody else, if he or someday she, is sick or something. But the clause that everybody is talking about right now is Section 4, which has language that seems, if I could just read part of it,
yeah.
Whenever the vice president and a majority of either the principal officer of the executive departments or of such other body as Congress may law provide, transmit to the president pro temp of the Senate and Speaker the written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties, the vice president shall immediately assume the powers and duties of the office of acting president. And that seems to have to set up a process here where those closest to the president, if they reach a conclusion and say something's the matter, you know, he's very ill, psychotic, you know, who knows, whatever it is or something like that, that there's a way that the president can be removed, mm-hmm. and the vice president can take over.
Okay, so, yeah, I've got my New York Times Constitution in front of me from Sunday's paper. And it says, as you just read, their written declaration that the president is unable to discharge the powers and duties of his office. Okay, I got a question about that. Who needs to sign off on that? How does that get started? And doesn't it require the vice president of the Congress, which is Republican? Doesn't it require their consent? So what chance does this have if it's a mental thing as opposed to physical? The president was shot. Dave, respond to that in just a minute. This is WGN. I'm John Williams. Dave Schultz is a professor of constitutional law at the University of Minnesota, a frequent guest on this show, answering questions about how the Constitution works. We're talking about the 25th Amendment, and Dave, you read a little of it to us, and it says that the Congress or somebody has the power to sort of take the president out of office if he's unable to discharge his duties. It's kind of vague, though, isn't it? And how does that work?
Well, it is vague, and that's the one clause of the 25th Amendment, the fourth section, that's never been invoked, and it's just not clear, because it says that, you know, executive members, you know, in the White House shall make the decision. It's not clear who's supposed to make that decision. They're supposed to transmit it to Congress. It's not exactly sure, you know, how this transmission process occurs. And then there's a clause in there that also says that the president can send a letter to Congress afterwards indicating that he is fit to take his office again. So I just mention this because there is a lot of vagueness. It's never been invoked before, and no one really knows how it works at all. And in the situation here where you have a Republican president, Republican vice president, Republican Congress, I'm just not sure this is a realistic option for people who dislike Donald Trump to have him removed from office.
Well, I'm just going to read that first half of that first sentence again. Whenever the vice president and a majority of, and then it goes on to say other people, but doesn't it require the vice president to sign off on this? If the president were going to be forced out of office because you thought, oh, gee, it's too much for him, he can't handle the stress, he's lashing out at his enemies, real and imagined, so we need to do him and the country a favor. But it doesn't that require the Mike Pence would have to agree to this, right?
Absolutely correct.
Well, he's not going to agree to this. I mean, not yet. All that we've seen right now, people roll their eyes and say, oh, that's bad behavior. But I haven't seen any of the people in positions of power saying that they actually question his mental ability right now. You know what I mean?
I agree. And also, I was going to say, for the 40% of the population who still supports Donald Trump, according to opinion polls, they would agree with you also. They don't see anything in his behavior that would indicate that he needs to be removed from office either.
Suppose, though, there were a group in Congress, a bunch of Democrats, who do want to try and invoke this. Can they petition the Congress, sort of like an impeachment process? That is, you don't have to convict, you don't have to find that he's incompetent, but we just want to bring it up. Do they have an opportunity to at least invoke this 25th Amendment?
Well, they can talk about it. They could encourage people to consider the 25th Amendment. But at the end of the day, it's going to take some action on the part of the Vice President of the United States, and there's no petition process that members of Congress, including Democrats, could use to force this part of the Constitution to be invoked.
Well, and that strikes me as a flaw in the system, in that if the Vice President signs off on it, but it's vague, but the Vice President is on board, it could be debated, right? But he has a conflict of interest here, doesn't he? Because then he gets to be the president. So maybe we shouldn't ask him. We should ask somebody who's a little removed from, you know, the office.
That is possible, but the text of the Constitution the vice president. And so whether we think it's a good idea or not, at some point, the Constitution and its words matter. And I think the framers, drafters of this amendment, were putting some faith in the fact that the vice president would act in the best interest of the country in making these decisions.
And by the way, but this isn't like 1802 we're talking about here. This is 1967, isn't it?
Correct.
Well, I mean, those guys, I presume some of them are still around who drafted this, who knew the intent. Mm-hmm. I wonder if they were anticipating something like this and what they would want us to do. What do they intend for this 25th Amendment to be used for?
And that's a great question here, because clearly most of it is about physical incapacitation.
Right.
And I suspect even the fourth section is about physical incapacitation. It's not about when you think somebody is crazy or they disagree with you or you don't like what they have to say. Just because you don't like the politics or the views or antics of the president of the United States doesn't give you the right to remove them.
I think that's an enormous point. Last two texts. John, interesting that your guest noted Lincoln. I'm reading a book on Lincoln's war strategy. Lincoln actually violated portions of the Constitution, suspension of writ of habeas corpus, etc. This does happen sometimes where the Constitution doesn't win. And John, my 15-year-old's really interested in the political system. Does your guest recommend a book my son could read to learn more on the Constitution? What do you say to that one?
Well, the first one, in terms of Lincoln, yes, but eventually the courts did come back in terms of responding and putting checks on what the president did. If I were going to pick one single book on the Constitution, there's a great history book called The American Constitution, and a bunch of authors, but the first author is Kelly. It's considered probably the best, I'd say one of the best books on the history of the Constitution from the framers all the way up to the 21st century.
The American Constitution, and one of the authors is named Kelly.
Kelly and Harbinson are the authors.
Kelly and Harbinson. By the way, what's the best book you've ever written?
Boy, it's always a tough one. I actually think my forthcoming constitutional law textbook is pretty good. And so I would put that on the list.
Well, I'm going to talk to you when that comes out. This guy has a lot of interests, and they all aren't just about the Constitution. Dave, it's nice to talk to you. We'll visit again. Thanks for your help this afternoon.
Anytime, John, and hello to Chicago.
That's Dave Schultz. He's a professor of constitutional law at the University of Minnesota, and he writes about space, too.